case. But who knows? Said Ignatius Gallagher considerately. Next year I may take a little skip over here now that I've broken the ice. It's only a pleasure deferred.
Very well, said little Chandler. The next time you come, we must have an evening together. That's agreed now, isn't it?
Yes, that's agreed, said Ignatius Gallagher. Next year, if I come, parole d'honneur.
And to clinch the bargain, said little Chandler, we'll just have one more now. Ignatius Gallagher took out a large gold watch and looked at it.
Is it to be the last, he said, because, you know, I have an AP.
Oh, yes, positively, said little Chandler.
Very well, then, said Ignatius Gallagher. Let us have another one, as a jocund Doris. That's good vernacular for a small whiskey, I believe.
Little Chandler ordered the drinks. The blush which had risen to his face a few moments before was establishing itself. A trifle made him blush at any time, and now he felt warm and excited. Three small whiskies had gone to his head, and Gallagher's strong cigar had confused his mind, for he was a delicate and abstinent person. The adventure of meeting Gallagher after 8 years, of finding himself with Gallagher in Corliss's, surrounded by lights and noise, of listening to Gallagher's stories and of sharing for a brief space Gallagher's vagrant and triumphant life, upset the equipoise of his sensitive nature. He felt acutely the contrast between his own life and his friend's, and it seemed to him unjust. Gallagher was his inferior in birth and education. He was sure that he could do something better than his friend had ever done, or could ever do, something higher than mere tawdry journalism, if he only got the chance. What was it that stood in his way? His unfortunate timidity. He wished to vindicate himself in some way, to assert his manhood.
He saw behind Gallagher's refusal of his invitation. Gallagher was only patronizing him by his friendliness, just as he was patronizing Ireland by his visit. The barman brought their drinks. Little Chandler pushed one glass towards his friend and took up the other boldly.
Well, who knows, he said, as they lifted their glasses. When you come next year, I may have the pleasure of wishing long life and happiness to Mr. and Mrs. Ignatius Gallagher.
Ignatius Gallagher, in the act of drinking, closed one eye expressively over the rim of his glass. When he had drunk, he smacked his lips decisively, set down his glass, and said,
No blooming fear of that, my boy. I'm going to have my fling first and see a bit of life and the world before I put my head in the sack, if I ever do.
Some day you will, said little Chandler calmly.
Ignatius Gallagher turned his orange tie and slate blue eyes full upon his friend.
You think so? He said.
You'll put your head in the sack. Repeated little Chandler stoutly. Like everyone else, if you can find the girl. He had slightly emphasized his tone, and he was aware that he had betrayed himself. But though the color had heightened in his cheek, he did not flinch from his friend's gaze. Ignatius Gallagher watched him for a few moments, and then said,
If ever it occurs, you may bet your bottom dollar there'll be no mooning and spooning about it. I mean to marry money. She'll have a good fat account at the bank, or she won't do for me.
Little Chandler shook his head.
Why, man alive, said Ignatius Gallagher vehemently. Do you know what it is? I've only to say the word, and tomorrow I can have the woman and the cash. You don't believe it? Well, I know it. There are hundreds. What am I saying? Thousands of rich Germans and Jews rotten with money that it'd only be too glad. You wait a while, my boy. See if I don't play my cards properly. When I go about a thing, I mean business, I tell you. You just wait.
He tossed his glass to his mouth, finished his drink, and laughed loudly. Then he looked thoughtfully before him and said in a calmer tone,
But I'm in no hurry.
They can wait. I don't fancy tying myself up to one woman.
He imitated with his mouth the act of tasting and made a wry face.
Must get a bit stale, I should think.
he said. Little Chandler sat in the room off the hall, holding a child in his arms. To save money, they kept no servant, but Annie's younger sister, Monica, came for an hour or so in the morning, and an hour or so in the evening to help. But Monica had gone home long ago. It was 9:15. Little Chandler had come home late for tea, and moreover, he had forgotten to bring Annie home the parcel of coffee from Bewley's. Of course she was in a bad humour and gave him short answers. She said she would do without any tea, but when it came near the time at which the shop at the corner closed, she decided to go out herself for 1/4 pound of tea and 2 pounds of sugar. She put the sleeping child deftly in his arms and said, "Here, don't waken him." A little lamp with a white china shade stood upon the table, and its light fell over a photograph which was enclosed in a frame of crumpled horn. It was Annie's photograph. Little Chandler looked at it, pausing at the thin, tight lips. She wore the pale blue summer blouse which he had brought her home as a present one Saturday. It had cost him 10 and 11 pence, but what an agony of nervousness it had cost him. How he had suffered that day, waiting at the shop door until the shop was empty, standing at the counter and trying to appear at his ease while the girl piled ladies' blouses before him, paying at the desk and forgetting to take up the odd penny of his change, being called back by the cashier, and finally striving to hide his blushes as he left the shop by examining the parcel to see if it was securely tied. When he brought the blouse home, Annie kissed him and said it was very pretty and stylish. But when she heard the price, she threw the blouse on the table and said it was a regular swindle to charge 10 and 11 pence for that. At first she wanted to take it back, but when she tried it on, she was delighted with it, especially with the make of the sleeves, and kissed him and said he was very good to think of her. He looked coldly into the eyes of the photograph, and they answered coldly. Certainly they were pretty, and the face itself was pretty, but he found something mean in it. Why was it so unconscious and ladylike? The composure of the eyes irritated him. They repelled him and defied him. There was no passion in them, no rapture. He thought of what Gallagher had said about rich Jewesses, those dark oriental eyes. He thought, how full they are of passion, of voluptuous longing. Why had he married the eyes in the photograph? He caught himself up at the question and glanced nervously round the room. He found something mean in the pretty furniture which he had bought for his house on the hire system. Annie had chosen it herself, and it reminded him of her. It too was prim and pretty. A dull resentment against his life awoke within him. Could he not escape from his little house? Was it too late for him to try to live bravely like Gallagher? Could he go to London? There was the furniture still to be paid for. If he could only write a book and get it published, that might open the way for him. A volume of Byron's poems lay before him on the table. He opened it cautiously with his left hand, lest he should waken the child, and began to read the first poem in the book. Hushed are the winds, and still the evening gloom. Not e'en a zephyr wanders through the grove, whilst I return to view my Margaret's tomb, and scatter flowers on the dust I love. He paused. He felt the rhythm of the verse about him in the room. How melancholy it was. Could he, too, write like that, express the melancholy of his soul in verse? There were so many things he wanted to describe. His sensation of a few hours before, on Grattan Bridge, for example. If he could get back again into that mood. The child awoke and began to cry. He turned from the page and tried to hush it, but it would not be hushed. He began to rock it to and fro in his arms, but its wailing cry grew keener. He rocked it faster while his eyes began to read the second stanza. Within this narrow cell reclines her clay, that clay where one... It was useless. He couldn't read. He couldn't do anything. The wailing of the child pierced the drum of his ear and was useless. Useless! He was a prisoner for life. His arms trembled with anger, and suddenly bending to the child's face, he shouted, "Stop!" The child stopped for an instant, had a spasm of fright, and began to scream. He jumped up from his chair and walked hastily up and down the room with the child in his arms. It began to sob piteously, losing its breath for 4 or 5 seconds, and then bursting out anew. The thin walls of the room echoed the sound. He tried to soothe it, but it sobbed more convulsively. He looked at the contracted and quivering face of the child, and began to be alarmed. He counted 7 sobs without a break between them, and caught the child to his breast in fright. If it died... The door was burst open, and a young woman ran in, panting. "What is this? What is this?" she cried. The child, hearing its mother's voice, broke out into a paroxysm of sobbing. "It's nothing, Annie, it's nothing." He began to cry. She flung her parcels on the floor and snatched the child from him. "What have you done to him?" she cried, glaring into his face. Little Chandler sustained for one moment the gaze of her eyes, and his heart closed together as he met the hatred in them. He began to stammer. "It's nothing." He began to cry. I didn't do anything. What? Giving no heed to him, she began to walk up and down the room, clasping the child tightly in her arms, and murmuring, my little Manny, was so frightened, love. There now, love, there now. Lamb born, mama's the lamb of the world, there now. Little Chandler felt his cheeks suffused with shame, and he stood back out of the lamplight. He listened while the paroxysm of the child's sobbing grew less and less, and tears of remorse started to his eyes.
Counterparts. The bell rang furiously, and when Miss Parker went to the tube, a furious voice called out in a piercing North of Ireland accent, "Send Farrington here!" Miss Parker returned to her machine, saying to a man who was writing at a desk, "Mr. Alain wants you upstairs." The man muttered, "Blast him," under his breath, and pushed back his chair to stand up. When he stood up, he was tall and of great bulk. He had a hanging face, dark wine-coloured, with fair eyebrows and moustache. His eyes bulged forward slightly, and the whites of them were dirty. He lifted up the counter, and passing by the clients, went out of the office with a heavy step. He went heavily upstairs until he came to the second landing, where a door bore a brass plate with the inscription, "Mr. Alain." Here he halted, puffing with labour and vexation, and knocked. The shrill voice cried, "Come in!" The man entered Mr. Alain's room. Simultaneously, Mr. Alain, a little man wearing gold-rimmed glasses on a clean-shaven face, shot his head up over a pile of documents. The head itself was so pink and hairless that it seemed like a large egg reposing on the papers. Mr. Alain did not lose a moment.
"Farrington! What is the meaning of this? Why have I always to complain of you? May I ask you why you haven't made a copy of that contract between Bodley and Kerwin? I told you it must be ready by 4 o'clock."
"But Mr. Shelley said..."
Mr. Shelley said, sir, kindly attend to what I say and not to what Mr. Shelley says, sir. You have always some excuse or another for shirking work. Let me tell you that if the contract is not copied before this evening, I lay the matter out before Mr. Crosby. Do you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Do you hear me now? Aye, and another little matter. I might as well be talking to the wall as talking to you. Understand once for all that you get a half an hour for your lunch and not an hour and a half. How many courses do you want, I'd like to know? Do you mind me now?
Yes, sir. Mr. Alleyne bent his head again upon his pile of papers. The man stared fixedly at the polished skull which directed the affairs of Crosby and Alleyne, gauging its fragility. A spasm of rage gripped his throat for a few moments, and then passed, leaving after it a sharp sensation of thirst. The man recognized the sensation and felt that he must have a good night's drinking. The middle of the month was past, and if he could get the copy done in time, Mr. Alleyne might give him an order on the cashier. He stood still, gazing fixedly at the head upon the pile of papers. Suddenly, Mr. Alleyne began to upset all the papers, searching for something. Then, as if he had been unaware of the man's presence till that moment, he shot up his head again, saying,
"Huh? Are you going to stand there all day?"
"Upon my word, Farrington, you take things easy. I was waiting to see..."
"Very good. You needn't wait to see. Go downstairs and do your work."
The man walked heavily towards the door, and as he went out of the room, he heard Mr. Alleyne cry after him that if the contract was not copied by evening, Mr. Crosby would hear of the matter. He returned to his desk in the lower office and counted the sheets which remained to be copied. He took up his pen and dipped it in the ink, but he continued to stare stupidly at the last words he had written. "In no case shall the said Bernard Bodley be." The evening was falling, and in a few minutes they would be lighting the gas. Then he could write. He felt that he must slake the thirst in his throat. He stood up from his desk, and lifting the counter as before, passed out of the office. As he was passing out, the chief clerk looked at him inquiringly. "It's all right, Mr. Shelley," said the man, pointing with his finger to indicate the objective of his journey. The chief clerk glanced at the hat rack, but seeing the row complete, offered no remark. As soon as he was on the landing, the man pulled a shepherd's plaid cap out of his pocket, put it on his head, and ran quickly down the rickety stairs. From the street door he walked on furtively on the inner side of the path towards the corner, and all at once dived into a doorway. He was now safe in the dark snug of O'Neill's shop, and filling up the little window that looked into the bar with his inflamed face, the colour of dark wine or dark meat, he called out, "Here, Pat, give us a GP, like a good fellow." The curate brought him a glass of plain porter. The man drank it at a gulp and asked for a caraway seed. He put his penny on the counter, and leaving the curate to grope for it in the gloom, retreated out of the snug as furtively as he had entered it. Darkness, accompanied by a thick fog, was gaining upon the dusk of February, and the lamps in Eustace Street had been lit. The man went up by the houses until he reached the door of the office, wondering whether he could finish his copy in time. On the stairs, a moist, pungent odour of perfume saluted his nose. Evidently Miss Delacour had come while he was out in O'Neill's. He crammed his cap back again into his pocket and re-entered the office, assuming an air of absent-mindedness.
"Mr. Alleyne has been calling for you," said the chief clerk severely. "Where were you?"
The man glanced at the two clients who were standing at the counter, as if to intimate that their presence prevented him from answering. As the clients were both male, the chief clerk allowed himself a laugh.
"I know that game," he said. "Five times in one day is a little bit... You better look sharp and get a copy of our correspondence on the Delacour case for Mr. Alleyne."
This address in the presence of the public, his run upstairs, and the porter he had gulped down so hastily, confused the man, and as he sat down at his desk to get what was required, he realized how hopeless was the task of finishing his copy of the contract before 5:30. The dark, damp night was coming, and he longed to spend it in the bars, drinking with his friends amid the glare of gas and the clatter of glasses. He got out the Delacour correspondence and passed out of the office. He hoped Mr. Elaine would not discover that the last two letters were missing. The moist, pungent perfume lay all the way up to Mr. Elaine's room. Miss Delacour was a middle-aged woman of Jewish appearance. Mr. Elaine was said to be sweet on her, or on her money. She came to the office often and stayed a long time when she came. She was sitting beside his desk now in an aroma of perfumes, smoothing the handle of her umbrella and nodding the great black feather in her hat. Mr. Elaine had swiveled his chair round to face her and thrown his right foot jauntily upon his left knee. The man put the correspondence on the desk and bowed respectfully, but neither Mr. Elaine nor Miss Delacour took any notice of his bow. Mr. Elaine tapped a finger on the correspondence and then flicked it towards him as if to say, "That's all right, you can go." The man returned to the lower office and sat down again at his desk. He stared intently at the incomplete phrase, "In no case shall the said Bernard Bodley be," and thought how strange it was that the last three words began with the same letter. The chief clerk began to hurry Miss Parker, saying she would never have the letters typed in time for post. The man listened to the clicking of the machine for a few minutes, and then set to work to finish his copy. But his head was not clear, and his mind wandered away to the glare and rattle of the public house. It was a night for hot punches. He struggled on with his copy, but when the clock struck 5, he had still 14 pages to write. Blast it, he couldn't finish in time. He longed to execrate aloud, to bring his fist down on something violently. He was so enraged that he wrote Bernard, Bernard, instead of Bernard Bodley, and had to begin again on a clean sheet. He felt strong enough to clear out the whole office single-handed. His body ached to do something, to rush out and revel in violence. All the indignities of his life enraged him. Could he ask the cashier privately for an advance? No, the cashier was no good, no damn good. He wouldn't give an advance. He knew where he would meet the boys, Leonard and O'Halloran and Nosey Flynn. The barometer of his emotional nature was set for a spell of riot. His imagination had so abstracted him that his name was called twice before he answered. Mr. Elaine and Miss Delacour were standing outside the counter, and all the clerks had turned round in anticipation of something. The man got up from his desk. Mr. Elaine began a tirade of abuse, saying that two letters were missing. The man answered that he knew nothing about them, that he had made a faithful copy. The tirade continued. It was so bitter and violent that the man could hardly restrain his fist from descending upon the head of the mannequin before him. "I know nothing about any other two letters," he said stupidly.
"You know nothing? Of course you know nothing," said Mr. Elaine. "Tell me," he added, glancing first for approval to the lady beside him, "do you take me for a fool? Do you think me an utter fool?"
The man glanced from the lady's face to the little egg-shaped head and back again, and almost before he was aware of it, his tongue had found a felicitous moment. "I don't think, sir," he said, "that that's a fair question to put to me." There was a pause in the very breathing of the clerks. Everyone was astounded. The author of the witticism no less than his neighbours, and Miss Delacour, who was a stout, amiable person, began to smile broadly. Mr. Elaine flushed to the hue of a wild rose, and his mouth twitched with a dwarf's passion. He shook his fist in the man's face till it seemed to vibrate like the knob of some electric
machine. You impertinent ruffian. You impertinent ruffian. I'll make short work of you. Wait till you see. You'll apologize to me for your impertinence, or you'll quit the office instanter. You'll quit this, I'm telling you, or you'll apologize to me.
He stood in a doorway opposite the office, watching to see if the cashier would come out alone. All the clerks passed out, and finally the cashier came out with the chief clerk. It was no use trying to say a word to him when he was with the chief clerk. The man felt that his position was bad enough. He had been obliged to offer an abject apology to Mr. Alain for his impertinence, but he knew what a hornet's nest the office would be for him. He could remember the way in which Mr. Alain had hounded little Peek out of the office in order to make room for his own nephew. He felt savage and thirsty and revengeful, annoyed with himself and with everyone else. Mr. Alain would never give him an hour's rest. His life would be a hell to him. He had made a proper fool of himself this time. Could he not keep his tongue in his cheek? But they had never pulled together from the first, he and Mr. Alain, ever since the day Mr. Alain had overheard him mimicking his North of Ireland accent to amuse Higgins and Miss Parker. That had been the beginning of it. He might have tried Higgins for the money, but sure, Higgins never had anything for himself. A man with two establishments to keep up, of course he couldn't. He felt his great body again aching for the comfort of the public house. The fog had begun to chill him, and he wondered could he touch Pat in O'Neill's. He could not touch him for more than a bob, and a bob was no use. Yet he must get money somewhere or other. He had spent his last penny for the GP, and soon it would be too late for getting money anywhere. Suddenly, as he was fingering his watch chain, he thought of Terry Kelly's pawn office in Fleet Street. That was the dart. Why didn't he think of it sooner? He went through the narrow alley of Temple Bar quickly, muttering to himself that they could all go to hell because he was going to have a good night of it. The clerk in Terry Kelly's said a crown, but the consignor held out for 6 shillings, and in the end the 6 shillings was allowed him, literally. He came out of the pawn office joyfully, making a little cylinder of the coins between his thumb and fingers. In Westmoreland Street the footpaths were crowded with young men and women returning from business, and ragged urchins ran here and there, yelling out the names of the evening editions. The man passed through the crowd, looking on the spectacle generally with proud satisfaction, and staring masterfully at the office girls. His head was full of the noises of tram gongs and swishing trolleys, and his nose already sniffed the curling fumes of punch. As he walked on, he preconsidered the terms in which he would narrate the incident to the boys. So I just looked at him, coolly, you know, and looked at her. Then I looked back at him again, taking my time, you know. I don't think that that's a fair question to put to me, says I. Nosey Flynn was sitting up in his usual corner of Davy Burns, and when he heard the story, he stood Farrington a half one, saying it was as smart a thing as ever he heard. Farrington stood a drink in his turn. After a while, O'Halloran and Paddy Leonard came in, and the story was repeated to them. O'Halloran stood tailors of malt, hot all around, and told the story of the retort he had made to the chief clerk when he was in Callan's of Found Street. But as the retort was after the manner of the liberal shepherds in the eclogues, he had to admit that it was not so clever as Farrington's retort. At this, Farrington told the boys to polish off that and have another. Just as they were naming their poisons, who should come in but Higgins? Of course he had to join in with the others. The men asked him to give his version of it, and he did so with great vivacity, for the sight of 5 small hot whiskies was very exhilarating. Everyone roared laughing when he showed the way in which Mr. Alain shook his fist in Farrington's face. Then he imitated Farrington, saying, "And here was my nabs, as cool as you please." While Farrington looked at the company out of his heavy, dirty eyes, smiling and at times drawing forth stray drops of liquor from his moustache with the aid of his lower lip. When that round was over, there was a pause. O'Halloran had money, but neither of the other two seemed to have any, so the whole party left the shop, somewhat regretfully. At the corner of Duke Street, Higgins and Nosey Flynn bevelled off to the left, while the other three turned back towards the city. Rain was drizzling down on the cold streets, and when they reached the ballast office, Farrington suggested the Scotch House. The bar was full of men and loud with the noise of tongues and glasses. The three men pushed past the whining match-sellers at the door and formed a little party at the corner of the counter. They began to exchange stories. Leonard introduced them to a young fellow named Weathers, who was performing at the Tivoli as an acrobat and knockabout artiste. Farrington stood a drink all round. Weathers said he would take a small Irish and Apollinaris. Farrington, who had definite notions of what was what, asked the boys would they have an Apollinaris too, but the boys told Tim to make theirs hot. The talk became theatrical. O'Halloran stood around, and then Farrington stood another round, Weathers protesting that the hospitality was too Irish. He promised to get them in behind the scenes and introduce them to some nice girls. O'Halloran said that he and Leonard would go, but that Farrington wouldn't go because he was a married man, and Farrington's heavy, dirty eyes leered at the company in token that he understood he was being chaffed. Weathers made them all have just one little tincture at his expense and promised to meet them later on at Mulligan's in Poolbeg Street. When the Scotch House closed, they went round to Mulligan's. They went into the parlour at the back, and O'Halloran ordered small hot specials all round. They were all beginning to feel mellow. Farrington was just standing another round when Weathers came back. Much to Farrington's relief, he drank a glass of bitter this time. Funds were running low, but they had enough to keep them going. Presently, two young women with big hats and a young man in a check suit came in and sat at a table close by. Weathers saluted them and told the company they were out at the Tivoli. Farrington's eyes wandered at every moment in the direction of one of the young women. There was something striking in her appearance. An immense scarf of peacock blue muslin was wound round her hat and knotted in a great bow under her chin, and she wore bright yellow gloves reaching to the elbow. Farrington gazed admiringly at the plump arm, which she moved very often and with much grace, and when after a little time she answered his gaze, he admired still more her large dark brown eyes. The oblique staring expression in them fascinated him. She glanced at him once or twice, and when the party was leaving the room, she brushed against his chair and said, "Oh, pardon," in a London accent. He watched her leave the room in the hope that she would look back at him, but he was disappointed. He cursed his want of money and cursed all the rounds he had stood, particularly all the whiskies and Apollinaris which he had stood to Weathers. If there was one thing that he hated, it was a sponge. He was so angry that he lost count of the conversation of his friends. When Paddy Leonard called him, he found that they were talking about feats of strength. Weathers was showing his biceps muscle to the company and boasting so much that the other two had called on Farrington to uphold the national honour. Farrington pulled up his sleeve accordingly and showed his biceps muscle to the company. The two arms were examined and compared, and finally it was agreed to have a trial of strength. The table was cleared, and the two men rested their elbows on it, clasping hands. When Paddy Leonard said, "Go!" each was to try to bring down the other's hand onto the table. Farrington looked very serious and determined. The trial began. After about 30 seconds, Weathers brought his opponent's hand slowly down onto the table. Farrington's dark wine-coloured face flushed darker still with anger and humiliation at having been defeated by such a stripling. "You're not to put the weight of your body behind it. Play fair," he said. "He's not playing fair," said the other. "Come on again, the two best out of three." The trial began again. The veins stood out on Farrington's forehead, and the pallor of Weather's complexion changed to peony. Their hands and arms trembled under the stress. After a long struggle, Weathers again brought his opponent's hand slowly onto the table. There was a murmur of applause from the spectators. The curate, who was standing beside the table, nodded his red head towards the victor and said, with loutish familiarity, "Ah, that's the knack." "What the hell do you know about it?" said Farrington, fiercely turning on the man. "What do you put in your gab for?" "Shh," said O'Halloran, observing the violent expression of Farrington's face. "Pony up, boys. We'll have just one little smahan more and we'll be off." A very sullen-faced man stood at the corner of O'Connell Bridge, waiting for the little Sandymount tram to take him home. He was full of smouldering anger and revengefulness. He felt humiliated and discontented. He did not even feel drunk. And he had only twopence in his pocket. He cursed everything. He had done for himself in the office, pawned his watch, spent all his money, and he had not even got drunk. He began to feel thirsty again, and he longed to be back again in the hot, reeking public house. He'd lost his reputation as a strong man, having been defeated twice by a mere boy. His heart swelled with fury, and when he thought of the woman in the big hat who had brushed against him and said, "Pardon," his fury nearly choked him. His tram let him down at Shelburne Road, and he steered his great body along in the shadow of the wall of the barracks. He loathed returning to his home. When he went in by the side door, he found the kitchen empty and the kitchen fire nearly out. He bawled upstairs.
"Ada! Ada!"
His wife was a little sharp-faced woman who bullied her husband when he was sober and was bullied by him when he was drunk. They had 5 children. A little boy came running down the stairs.
"Who's that?"
said the man, peering through the darkness.
"Me, Pa."
"Who are you, Charlie?"
"No, Pa, Tom. Where's your mother?" "She's out at the chapel."
"That's right.
Did she think of leaving any dinner for me?"
"Yes, Pa.
Light the lamp." "What do you mean by having the place in darkness? Are the other children in bed?"
The man sat down heavily on one of the chairs while the little boy lit the lamp. He began to mimic his son's flat accent, saying half to himself,
"At the chapel. At the chapel, if you please."
When the lamp was lit, he banged his fists on the table and shouted,
"What's for my dinner?"
"I'm going to cook it, Pa," said the little boy.
The man jumped up furiously and pointed to the fire.
"On that fire? You let the fire out! By God, I'll teach you to do that again!"
He took a step to the door and seized the walking stick which was standing behind it.
"I'll teach you to let the fire out," he said,
rolling up his sleeve in order to give his arm free play. The little boy cried,
"Oh, Pa,"
and ran whimpering round the table, but the man followed him and caught him by the coat. The little boy looked about him wildly, but seeing no way of escape, fell upon his knees.
"Now you let the fire out the next time,"
said the man, striking at him viciously with the stick.
"Take that, you little whelp!"
The boy uttered a squeal of pain as the stick cut his thigh. He clasped his hands together in the air, and his voice shook with fright.
"Pa,"
he cried.
"Don't beat me, Pa, and I'll say Hail Mary for you. I'll say Hail Mary for you, Pa, if you don't beat me. Oh, say Hail Mary!"
Play. The matron had given her leave to go out as soon as the woman's tea was over, and Maria looked forward to her evening out. The kitchen was spick and span. The cook said you could see yourself in the big copper boilers. The fire was nice and bright, and on one of the side tables were four very big barm bracks. These barm bracks seemed uncut, but if you went closer, you would see that they'd been cut into long, thick, even slices, and were ready to be handed round at tea. Maria had cut them herself. Maria was a very, very small person indeed, but she had a very long nose and a very long chin. She talked a little through her nose, always soothingly, "Yes, my dear," and "No, my dear." She was always sent for when the women quarrelled over their tubs, and always succeeded in making peace. One day the matron had said to her, "Maria, you are a veritable peacemaker." And the sub-matron and two of the board ladies had heard the compliment, and Ginger Mooney was always saying what she wouldn't do to the dummy who had charge of the irons if it wasn't for Maria. Everyone was so fond of Maria. The women would have their tea at 6 o'clock, and she would be able to get away before 7. From Ball's Bridge to the Pillar, 20 minutes. From the Pillar to Drumcondra, 20 minutes. And 20 minutes to buy the things. She would be there before 8. She took out her purse with the silver clasps and read again the words, "A present from Belfast." She was very fond of that purse because Joe had brought it to her 5 years before when he and Alfie had gone to Belfast on a Whit Monday trip. In the purse were 2 half-crowns and some coppers. She would have 5 shillings clear after paying tram fare. What a nice evening they would have, all the children singing. Only she hoped that Joe wouldn't come in drunk. He was so different when he took any drink. Often he had wanted her to go and live with them, but she would have felt herself in the way, though Joe's wife was ever so nice with her. And she had become accustomed to the life of the laundry. Joe was a good fellow. She had nursed him, and Alfie too. And Joe used to often say, "Mama is Mama, but Maria is my proper mother." After the breakup at home, the boys had got her that position in the Dublin by Lamplight Laundry, and she liked it. She used to have such a bad opinion of Protestants, but now she thought they were very nice people, a little quiet and serious, but still very nice people to live with. Then she had her plants in the conservatory, and she liked looking after them. She had lovely ferns and wax plants, and whenever anyone came to visit her, she always gave the visitor 1 or 2 slips from her conservatory. There was one thing she didn't like, and that was the tracts on the walls. But the matron was such a nice person to deal with, so genteel. When the cook told her everything was ready, she went into the women's room and began to pull the big bell. In a few minutes, the women began to come in by 2s and 3s, wiping their steaming hands in their petticoats and pulling down the sleeves of their blouses over their red steaming arms. They settled down before their huge mugs, which the cook and the dummy filled up with hot tea, already mixed with milk and sugar, in huge tin cans. Maria superintended the distribution of the barm brack and saw that every woman got her 4 slices. There was a great deal of laughing and joking during the meal. Lizzie Fleming said Maria was sure to get the ring, and though Fleming had said that for so many Hallow Eves, Maria had to laugh and say she didn't want any ring or man either. And when she laughed, her grey-green eyes sparkled with disappointed shyness, and the tip of her nose nearly met the tip of her chin. Then Ginger Mooney lifted up her mug of tea and proposed Maria's health, while all the other women clattered with their mugs on the table and said she was sorry she hadn't a sup of porter to drink it in. And Maria laughed again till the tip of her nose nearly met the tip of her chin, until her minute body nearly shook itself asunder, because she knew that Mooney meant well, though. Of course, she had the notions of a common woman. But wasn't Maria glad when the women had finished their tea and the cook and the dummy had begun to clear away the tea things? She went into her little bedroom and, remembering that the next morning was a mass morning, changed the hand of the alarm from 7 to 6. Then she took off her working skirt and her house boots
and laid her best skirt out in bed and her tiny dress boots beside the foot of the bed. She changed her blouse, too, and as she stood before the mirror, she thought of how she used to dress for Mass on Sunday morning when she was a young girl, and she looked with quaint affection at the diminutive body which she had so often adorned. In spite of its years, she found it a nice, tidy little body. When she got outside, the streets were shining with rain, and she was glad of her old brown rain cloak. The tram was full, and she had to sit on the little stool at the end of the car, facing all the people, with her toes barely touching the floor. She arranged in her mind all she was going to do, and thought how much better it was to be independent and to have your own money in your pocket. She hoped they would have a nice evening. She was sure they would, but she could not help thinking what a pity it was Alfie and Joe were not speaking. They were always falling out now. But when they were boys together, they used to be the best of friends. But such was life. She got out of her tram at the pillar and ferreted her way quickly among the crowds. She went into Down's cake shop, but the shop was so full of people that it was a long time before she could get herself attended to. She bought a dozen of mixed penny cakes and at last came out of the shop laden with a big bag. Then she thought, what else would she buy? She wanted to buy something really nice. They would be sure to have plenty of apples and nuts. It was hard to know what to buy, and all she could think of was cake. She decided to buy some plum cake, but Down's plum cake had not enough almond icing on top of it, so she went over to a shop in Henry Street. Here she was a long time in suiting herself, and the stylish young lady behind the counter, who was evidently a little annoyed by her, asked her was it wedding cake she wanted to buy. That made Maria blush and smile at the young lady, but the young lady took it all very seriously and finally cut a thick slice of plum cake, parcelled it up and said, 2 and 4, please. She thought that she would have to stand in the Drumcondra tram because none of the young men seemed to notice her, but an elderly gentleman made room for her. He was a stout gentleman and he wore a brown hard hat. He had a square red face and a greyish moustache. Maria thought he was a colonel-looking gentleman, and she reflected how much more polite he was than the young men who simply stared straight before them. The gentleman began to chat with her about Hallow Eve and the rainy weather. He supposed the bag was full of good things for the little ones and said it was only right that the youngsters should enjoy themselves while they were young. Maria agreed with him and favoured him with demure nods and hems. He was very nice with her, and when she was getting out at the canal bridge, she thanked him and bowed, and he bowed to her and raised his hat and smiled agreeably. And while she was going up along the terrace, bending her tiny head under the rain, she thought how easy it was to know a gentleman, even when he has a drop taken. Everybody said, "Oh, here's Maria," when she came to Joe's house. Joe was there, having come home from business, and all the children had their Sunday dresses on. There were two big girls in from next door, and games were going on. Maria gave the bag of cakes to the eldest boy, Alfie, to divide, and Mrs. Donnelly said it was too good of her to bring such a big bag of cakes and made all the children say, "Thanks, Maria." But Maria said she had brought something special for Papa and Mama, something they would be sure to like, and she began to look for her plum cake. She tried in Down's bag and then in the pockets of her rain cloak and then on the hall stand, but nowhere could she find it. Then she asked all the children had any of them eaten it by mistake, of course, but the children all said no and looked as if they did not like to eat cakes if they were to be accused of stealing. Everybody had a solution for the mystery, and Mrs. Donnelly said it was plain that Maria had left it behind her in the tram. Maria, remembering how confused the gentleman with the greyish moustache had made her, coloured with shame and vexation and disappointment. At the thought of the failure of her little surprise and of the 2 and 4 pence she had thrown away for nothing, she nearly cried outright. But Joe said it didn't matter and made her sit down by the fire. He was very nice with her. He told her all that went on in his office, repeating for her a smart answer which he had made to the manager. Maria did not understand why Joe laughed so much over the answer he had made, but she said that the manager must have been a very overbearing person to deal with. Joe said he wasn't so bad when you knew how to take him, that he was a decent sort so long as he didn't rub him the wrong way. Mrs. Donnelly played the piano for the children, and they danced and sang. Then the two next-door girls handed round the nuts. Nobody could find the nutcrackers, and Joe was nearly getting cross over it and asked how did they expect Maria to crack nuts without a nutcracker. But Maria said she didn't like nuts, and they weren't to bother about her. Then Joe asked would she take a bottle of stout, and Mrs. Donnelly said there was port wine, too, in the house, if she would prefer that. Maria said she would rather they didn't ask her to take anything, but Joe insisted. So Maria let him have his way, and they sat by the fire talking over old times, and Maria thought she would put in a good word for Alfie. But Joe cried that God might strike him stone dead if ever he spoke a word to his brother again, and Maria said she was sorry she had mentioned the matter. Mrs. Donnelly told her husband it was a great shame for him to speak that way of his own flesh and blood, but Joe said that Alfie was no brother of his, and there was nearly being a row on the head of it. But Joe said that he would not lose his temper on account of the night it was, and asked his wife to open some more stout. The two next-door girls had arranged some Halloween games, and soon everything was merry again. Maria was delighted to see the children so merry, and Joe and his wife in such good spirits. The next-door girls put some saucers on the table and then led the children up the table blindfold. One got the prayer book and the other three got the water, and when one of the next door girls got the ring, Mrs. Donnelly shook her finger at the blushing girl as much as to say, "Ah, I know all about it." They insisted then on blindfolding Maria and leading her up to the table to see what she would get, and while they were putting on the bandage, Maria laughed and laughed again till the tip of her nose nearly met the tip of her chin. They led her up to the table amid laughing and joking, and she put her hand out in the air as she was told to do. She moved her hand about here and there in the air and descended on one of the saucers. She felt a soft, wet substance with her fingers and was surprised that nobody spoke or took off her bandage. There was a pause for a few seconds and then a great deal of scuffling and whispering. Somebody said something about the garden. And at last Mrs. Donnelly said something very cross to one of the next-door girls and told her to throw it out at once. That was no play. Maria understood that it was wrong that time, and so she had to do it over again, and this time she got the prayer book. After that, Mrs. Donnelly played Miss MacLeod's reel for the children, and Joe made Maria take a glass of wine. Soon they were all quite merry again, and Mrs. Donnelly said Maria would enter a convent before the year was out because she had got the prayer book. Maria had never seen Joe so nice to her as he was that night, so full of pleasant talk and reminiscences. She said they were all very good to her. At last the children grew tired and sleepy, and Joe asked Maria would she not sing some little song before she went, one of the old songs. Mrs. Donnelly said, "Do, please, Maria," and so Maria had to get up and stand beside the piano. Mrs. Donnelly bade the children be quiet and listen to Maria's song. Then she played the prelude and said, "Now, Maria," and Maria, blushing very much, began to sing in a tiny, quavering voice. She sang, "I dreamt that I dwelt," and when she came to the second verse, she sang again, "I dreamt that I dwelt in marble halls, with vassals and serfs at my side, and of all who assembled within those walls, that I was the hope and the pride. I had riches too great to count, could boast of a high ancestral name, but I also dreamt, which pleased me most, that you loved me still the same." But no one tried to show her mistake. And when she had ended her song, Joe was very much moved. He said that there was no time like the long ago, and no music for him like poor old Balf, whatever other people might say. And his eyes filled up so much with tears that he could not find what he was looking for, and in the end he had to ask his wife to tell him where this corkscrew was.
A painful case. Mr. James Duffy lived in Chapel Izzard because he wished to live as far as possible from the city, of which he was a citizen, and because he found all the other suburbs of Dublin mean, modern, and pretentious. He lived in an old sombre house, and from his windows he could look into the disused distillery, or upwards along the shallow river on which Dublin is built. The lofty walls of his uncarpeted room were free from pictures. He had himself bought every article of furniture in the room, a black iron bedstead, an iron washstand, 4 cane chairs, a clothes rack, a coal scuttle, a fender and irons, and a square table on which lay a double desk. A bookcase had been made in an alcove by means of shelves of white wood. The bed was clothed with white bedclothes, and a black and scarlet rug covered the foot. A little hand mirror hung above the washstand, and during the day a white-shaded lamp stood as the sole ornament of the mantelpiece. The books on the white wooden shelves were arranged from below upwards according to bulk. A complete Wordsworth stood at one end of the lowest shelf, and a copy of the Maynooth Catechism, sewn into the cloth cover of a notebook, stood at one end of the top shelf. Writing materials were always on the desk. In the desk lay a manuscript translation of Hauptmann's Michael Kramer, the stage directions of which were written in purple ink, and a little sheaf of papers held together by a brass pin. In these sheets a sentence was inscribed from time to time, and in an ironical moment the headline of an advertisement for bile beans had been pasted onto the first sheet. On lifting the lid of the desk, a faint fragrance escaped, the fragrance of new cedarwood pencils, or of a bottle of gum, or of an overripe apple which might have been left there and forgotten. Mr. Duffy abhorred anything which betokened physical or mental disorder. A medieval doctor would have called him saturnine. His face, which carried the entire tale of his years, was of the brown tint